My type A-ness will just require me to straighten my name out. Thank you. All right, committee, thank you for waiting for me. I do appreciate that. Sorry that I'm late. I will make up for it at other times, I assure you that. On the agenda today, we have several bills we'll be hearing. We've received some amendments for both House Bill 2167 and House Bill 2168. I've had some conversations with the Secretary of State's office regarding both those bills that I will discuss when we discuss the bills themselves. Now, it's been a public hearing on House Bill 2167. Cletus, if you would be so kind as to
catch up to you,
give us an overview of what 2167 does, both I, the committee, and those in attendance would be greatly appreciative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2167 Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2167 relates to election laws. It relates to some housekeeping that's been provided by the Secretary of State related to ballots and voting in Oregon.
Thank you, Cletus. Appreciate that. At this time, I would like to call Fred Neal, the Honorable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Fred Neal. I'm the campaign finance manager for the State Elections Division, Secretary of State's office. House Bill 2167 is the Secretary's campaign finance housekeeping measure. I know this is an esoteric subject that is little on anyone's mind at any time, and these are indeed housekeeping provisions. We hope that none of them are considered policy matters, substantive policy matters, but they are ways to simply clean up the statutes that get modified over the different sessions. And we've been tracking those necessary changes for some time, and in fact have discovered two more technical changes that are before you in the -2 amendments. So distributed for you today is a section-by-section summary of all 27 sections. And I won't dwell on this much at all, but to just point out the one area where there may be some policy concern or that raises policy issues is in the first section. The amendment to ORS 260.05, there's a definition of independent, this is the definition section of ORS Chapter 260, there's a definition of independent expenditures that is vestigial, if you will, from ballot measure 9, and nowhere in ORS Chapter 260 now is the term independent expenditure used, but in ORS 260.044, someone has to file a statement of independent or individual expenditures if they make an expenditure on behalf or in opposition of a candidate or a measure, and that statement isn't otherwise reported by the benefiting committee or measure, proponents or opponents. And so what we've chosen to do is to not repeal or eliminate the definition of independent expenditure, but to nail it down in 044 and have 044 specifically refer to independent expenditures and provide everybody in the electoral process a roadmap, the definition that we've been giving over the phone as an advice. Well, here's really the common sense definition of independent expenditure to tell you whether you're supposed to file this form or you're supposed to form a political committee and file reports as a political committee, or telling a candidate whether or not this expenditure, this mail on their behalf, they had nothing, they didn't have any prior knowledge of whether that's an independent expenditure or not, and something that they don't have to report on their CNE report. And so that's all we're trying to do here, is to close that loop. And there is a case that interpreted in Oregon 260044 that eliminated the ability of issue ads. In the federal elections realm, that's called soft money expenditures. We don't have that here, distinction made. The Crumpton case by the Oregon Court of Appeals, review denied by the Oregon Supreme Court, said basically you don't have to have magic words, vote for, don't vote for, choose Kim Thatcher, don't choose Kim Thatcher, in order to actually have a message that is a political message that is on behalf or in support of a candidate such as Kim Thatcher or a measure. And so what the court decided by adopting, through the Crumpton case, the Fergatch test, I'm doing this not just for your benefit, but for the legislative record on this, is to say that expressly advocate includes not just magic words, like vote for, vote against, but a message that is names the committee or names the candidate, says something pro or con, that a reasonable listener listening to it would conclude, oh, I'm supposed to do something about this, and it's clear from the message what I'm supposed to do, vote for or vote against, without having the message itself have to be that express, that explicit. And we would not change that interpretation. We do not believe that this definition changes or overturns or anyhow in any way dilutes the Crumpton decision. It does not explicitly lay out the Crumpton test in code. You're certainly welcome to do that. You might want to do it in a substantive bill and not in a housekeeping measure, but that's, I just thought I needed to raise that issue so that you're aware of it here, because it is dipping into both statutes, the definition of independent expenditure and the independent expenditure statute itself, 260044, section 7, which I'll get to in a second. That's the most complicated section that you have to chew on in this bill. So do you have any questions about that?
Which section?
One.
point well taken.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mark.
Thank you. And Fred, thank you for coming and putting those issues on the record. As I read this, this basically clarifies that that those standards apply not only for or against a candidate, but for or against a measure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, and since passage of Measure 9, Mr. Chair, Representative March, we've told measure committees that same thing, for guidelines for them on whether or not they had to report expenditures that they or their campaigns hadn't participated in as in-kind contributions, or that it was incumbent on the persons making those expenditures to report them as independent expenditures.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Fred, as defined currently, if a 501c3, for example, or I guess it's C4 in this case, which cannot advocate for or against a particular candidate, however, they can spend money in an informative fashion, i.e., ballot measure 37 would do X, Y, and Z. If, in fact, you agree with what ballot measure 37 would do, we would encourage you to vote yes. Now, that would be taking a side, correct?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, a 501c4 can do that with issues. They can't do it with candidates.
Okay. Would that be defined, if they were to spend money, would that be defined as an independent expenditure then? On behalf of something?
It depends on the actual content of the message, Mr. Chair. We did with the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, TOFCO, case, determined that because they named, they had a 501c3, they were using foundation grant funds for smoking education efforts or anti-smoking education efforts, and at the same time as there was there were two measures on the ballot, there was a campaign for and against those measures. They provided educational advertising that named the measures and made it quite clear that the measures didn't meet their tests, laid out a test and didn't meet them. And we determined that those were political expenditures that needed to be reported.
Okay.
And we would do that again.
Okay. Now, Fred, I'm going to go to one more example, and I'm going to give you the example, and if you could tell me what it would be classified as. Recently, I saw a commercial for what's called the First Tee, T-E-E, which is a federal program, but for purpose of this conversation, assume it's a state program. It's called the First Tee. It's a government-sponsored program dealing with getting youth of all backgrounds into golf. They're currently running campaign in an ad campaign on TV promoting or informing about this program, not saying whether it's good or it's bad, just that it's here and here's a website. Where would something like that fall under?
Well, because it doesn't relate to any measure on a ballot in Oregon, we don't care.
Okay.
You know, it really has to be specifically relating to a question, either an electoral contest between candidates or a measure,
okay,
state or local, that's on a ballot. And it's got to be on the ballot. We pretty much let people say they can spend all the money they want with under Oregon law currently opposing an initiative petition without having to report those expenditures to us or where they're getting the money for that, because ORS Chapter 260 says you're not a political committee, it's not a political expenditure until that initiative has qualified to the ballot and it's been certified to the ballot.
So
with the First Tee, it's simply public education, public service.
So how would that, if you were to translate that same scenario and those same parameters into a ballot measure? Let's just stick with continuity. Ballot measure 37.
Mm-hmm.
Ballot measure 37. The TV commercial comes up. It's saying Oregon voters have a ballot measure before them this November. The ballot measure would do X, Y, and Z. This has been a public service message of whomever you would like. Would that be an independent expenditure? It's not advocating for or against, but it's dealing with a ballot measure that people are asked to, I guess, take a stand one way or the other on.
Yes, but not by that message itself, provided that message doesn't characterize Measure 37 in a way that one would say, oh, the person who's paying for this ad wants me to think that X is bad, Y is worse, and Z is heinous. And doesn't say that it's on necessarily on the ballot. It has done that. So we just have to look at the context of it.
So it's case by case basis,
yeah,
then on something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, good line of
Mr.
question.
Chair, I have a question.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Section 7, clarifies that a conduit of a political contribution must forward the contribution to the intended recipient within 7 business days.
Yeah,
am I jumping ahead?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me get to that. That 044 does more than just talk about independent expenditures.
Okay.
So. Okay.
That's agreeable.
If you don't mind, Representative, quickly then running through the other 25 sections of the bill. In the past, we've attempted, and this all Section 2 is doing, is amending the exemptions of the definition of what's a contribution or expenditure to extend membership communications or corporate communications from the definition so that it doesn't apply just to candidate messages, but also measure messages. So that's 007. Section 3 deletes some requirements from statements of organization for alternate committee addresses, a description of how the committee intends to raise funds, and a statement as whether the committee intends to exist for more than 1 year or not. Things that we don't quite understand what the purpose ever was underlying the legislature requiring those. We'd like to clean up the forms, make it a little simpler for people, and this is one way to do that. Section 4 adds Section 5 to the bill, and this is new law. It would allow the finance officer to discontinue a political committee if it has not filed a campaign finance report and directs the Secretary of State to adopt the rules prescribing the conditions and procedures for those discontinuations. We at the state level, as well as the local filing officers, have a number of especially candidate committees that are years old that may have had some minuscule remaining balance and or the candidate has left the state, has died, has never discontinued the committee, and we can't get them to get to a zero balance and to discontinue. We'd like the authority to clean up our files and to stop sending letters that always come back to us. Address. And I know from conferences with clerks and with the municipal recorders, they'd love to have this authority too. We'd be very careful in adopting the rules so we're not eliminating people that don't want to be eliminated as political committees. We have some of those with minimal balances and haven't been active for years, but somehow cling to the fact that they are a treasurer of a political committee. But that's what this bill, Section 5, would do. Section 6, again, is cleaning up the statements of organization but for political committees. Representative Holden.
Thank you, Fred. I just have a question about Section 5 before we go on to Section 6, and I, you know, trying not to get lost in all this. When you say you're able to discontinue statement of organization or committee for somebody who hasn't filed, you know, statement of contributions received or expenditures, is there any kind of, I'm not seeing a, and maybe it's listed in here somewhere else, that is there a time limit on that or a time frame that, you know, after so much time goes by, then you can discontinue them, or is it immediate, or what's the issue there?
Chair, Representative Holby, that is the context in which we would apply this. When trying to draft this, we pulled up over the, you know, the last 10 years of these types of committees and tried to come up with some language that would work statutorily and couldn't really. There's the sort of case-by-case issues, but they are these committees that we've contacted numerous times. They haven't filed. They kept a balance, so they haven't. So they have to file annual September supplemental reports. Haven't. We've got some staff members that are have come to us from the Department of Revenue and are good at tracking down people and failed in many cases and have succeeded in some. And so we make our best effort to find people and communicate with them, and then we have to make the effort of figuring out how they get to a zero balance and thus are able to discontinue. We would put those parameters in an administrative rule that's easier to adjust than trying to give you that responsibility of setting up something that then would not allow us to apply it in a particular case where it's to the benefit of the candidate and the treasurer and the filing officer. But it's a good question. We couldn't come up with the right language that would work universally for the statute, and we want to do it by rule.
Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Chair Kitts, this is a bit of a follow-up, but going back to what Representative Holvey asked, so you mentioned that they have to file each September?
Yes.
So would this be 1 year after the first filing?
Chair Kitts, Representative Farr, probably not. No, we... I think some people, especially district attorneys, judges with longer terms of office, and forgot after the fourth year that they're going to have to run again in 2 years later. And so we just send reminder notices. We would rarely apply this. It's just really just trying to get rid of those that don't want to be around. If somebody fails now as a candidate to file campaign finance reports during an election, they can't, if it's for the primary, they won't get a certificate of nomination. If it's for the general election, they can't get a certificate of office, certificate of election. So that we have that hammer for the people, for the immediate reports. And it's true that the September supplementals are when we most often get return mail, because people have lost, they had $3 left in their cash balance, and they don't want to think about it again, and they don't file a September report. We wouldn't discontinue at that point, but work with them to get a report in, and then see if they wouldn't really like to spend that last $3 and then get us out of their hair.
So does it make sense to have something in the language after every reasonable attempt has been made, and should there be a time limit listed in the statute?
That's 6 months, really your call. We would certainly apply that by rule and adopt that by rule, and you're welcome to comment on our rule adoption. But if you want to provide some guidelines, we're happy to work with you on that, too.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Fred.
Yeah. Section 6 is statements of organization for political committees, and again, we're just trying to, as I said earlier, trying to clean up some of the forms on that, and for recall committees, ask that statement of organization name the public officer against whom the recall petition is being filed. And this, well, I'll get into a little bit of that later about the recall statutes have some campaign finance provisions in it. And we're in this bill trying to make sure that somebody just reading 260 knows that there's something in 249 that they have to deal with, and somebody just reading 249 recall knows that they have responsibilities under 260. Now we get to Section 7. Again, referencing back to the new definition of independent expenditure and applying that to trigger the required reporting. There's some other provisions in 044. Besides that, including that you, if you got a contribution for somebody else and you hung on to it for more than 7 days, you had to be a political committee. And we want to say that that as the conduit, if you hung onto it more than 7 days, then you'd have to be a political committee. I mean, it's just so that there's some kind of time limitation in that. That is true now of you as candidates. You have to keep all of your accounts current within 7 days. And so that's why we picked that time period.
Are you referring to B on?
Yeah.
And what's B referring to? It seems
little C. Little C.
Above it. A person is not a political committee under subsection. All contributions delivered by the person is a candidate. So if I go around collecting a lot of money for the Fred Neal for Supreme Court Committee, for example, and keep, as long as I keep passing it on everything I have to you, I might collect $350,000 or something, but you'll be reporting it, so it's not
right.
An issue, and you'll be getting it within 7 days, so
right.
It doesn't matter then what I'm doing in that case.
Right. Correct. And we do get into, and we will in this bill, get into contributions of false name statute, which is coming up.
Yeah, but those could be perfectly legitimate.
Right, absolutely, and that's all. This is one of those conduit provisions in the statute that says we have individuals that if they solicit contributions on behalf of others, they are a political committee. Right? We can have a Lone Ranger political committee. We normally don't do that because that conflicts with the definition of a political committee, meaning two or more individuals. But so we're trying to just clarify in this statute that you're not a lone ranger, you're just a conduit if you're passing the money on, and you need to do that within 7 days. So you're not collecting interest on it. You're not suddenly deciding, well, because even though it's for a designated Supreme Court candidate, I'm going to spend it somewhere else or for that candidate's opponent. And suddenly then you would be a political committee and we would come after you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair Kitz. Back to my question, because I just want some clarification. It says, must forward the contribution to the intended recipient within 7 business days. Well, suppose that they do that, but the recipient doesn't go to their post office box to pick up the mail for 7 days after that. So then how are you regulating the date of receipt? Because if I'm given a contribution, then I can, the day that I actually get that envelope is my date of receipt, but that could be 14 days after it had been forwarded to me.
Yeah, we wouldn't make you be a political committee because the candidate you forwarded to took their time going to the post office box. If you, it was clear that you had forwarded it on, that's fine. I mean, it's the issue is timeliness of the reporting. Our concern would be with the candidate. They need to check their post office box.
Well, what would the proof? What would the required proof be, though? Would they need to have a receipt?
I don't think that we would even get that far. That we wouldn't even inquire.
It's correct me if I'm wrong, but it'd be similar to the reporting periods now, as they fall, you know, in accordance with when you receive a contribution, when you physically receive it, not when it was mailed, but it's when you received it within
right.
2 days reporting.
And our ruling with post office boxes is that that's within your control as the recipient candidate, so it's been delivered to you. You better check that at least every 7 days, because if that your contribution's been sitting there for 7 days, you've got to enter it into your books that seventh day, because it's been under your control, so it has been received by you, because you decide when you go to your post office box.
That's true, but I guess let me continue.
Okay.
There, because okay. The other thing that I was thinking is sometimes I've picked up mail and the postmark has been weeks before I received it.
Right, and I wouldn't be that concerned about it at this point. I mean, you just report it as soon as you can. When you know you have a contribution from someone, this statute's dealing with the conduit. And when she forwarded it, did she forward it within 7 business days of receiving it to the candidate? That's a little different in that she may have evidence of that or a receipt from the post office box if she felt that necessary, or a witness to it. I'm just not sure, quite frankly, if and when we would ever get that far with the conduit situation, unless it was an issue of contribution and a false name, and then it's who gave it to who, when, becomes very relevant, and for what purposes, for whose benefit.
Well, follow up. Well, the purpose of my question was relating to the conduit. So
yes.
if you're never going to get that far, then why does it need to be a rule?
Well, we took an existing statute that talks about conduits and says you don't have to be a committee. So if you do it within 7 days, that's all we just picked. Our standard 7-day rule and applied it.
All right, I'm still not sure that my question has been answered, but let me think on that, Chair.
Okay.
Representative March.
Thank you. This is a tricky area of law for some of us, particularly those of us receiving contributions.
Yeah.
And so I'll give you a hypothetical that maybe will help clarify for me anyhow. Let's say a gentleman with a dark jacket back there works for a company called Billy Beer, and they're a member of the Georgia Brewers Association. The Georgia Brewers Association decides to give me a check in the amount of $1,000, but they want Billy Beer's employee to hand it to me. So they send it to Billy Beer's employee, and he sits on it for 2 weeks before he calls me. Is that a violation under this provision? It is a violation under this provision.
For Billy.
For Billy.
Not for you and not for the Georgia Brewers Association. Yeah.
Okay. So this
would mean that Billy's probably sitting on a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of political money that's in the system, but in Billy's side pocket, back pocket.
Right, right.
And so this is just, if Billy started spending it otherwise, I think that's the only way the system or the Secretary of State's office, you know,
would know about it. Yeah.
Otherwise, you, the candidate, unless Georgia Brewers told you 2 weeks ago that they're sending it to Billy and he's supposed to get it to you, I'd get on them. <You know. laughs>
Representative Greenlake.
Yeah, I'd like to try this kind of just very briefly one more time.
Okay.
You said as long as I don't decide to send it on something else, and I've been thinking of a conduit the same way Steve just mentioned it.
Yeah.
I get a check and I give it to him, but could I be gathering checks in my name for Steve from you as long as I then write a check to him and say this came from Neil?
Well, you're probably converted. Then that's really what the statute is for. Is then you're a political committee because you're taking numerous contributions and then converting them. You should
even if
just forward the checks. Otherwise, you should have a Georgia Brewers pack and be depositing those. If the contributions are designated specifically for it, you should have that Georgia Brewer write that check to Representative March, and then you as Billy can forward it to them saying this is from one of our members. So that it is, because it was meant for Representative March from the get-go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I'm not sure, Representative March, did you vote for the $87 billion before you voted against it or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Not the first time, though.
Please continue, Fred.
Okay.
Never mind, Fred.
The other
Representative Holvey has a question.
So you can't get away from this too easily, I guess. I have another question about the conduit situation where, you know, the hypothetical of Representative Greenlick, you know, gathering money for the hypothetical Fred Neal for Supreme Court Justice Committee. And he gathers $51, several $51 cash contributions from several people and then gives them to you. Is he obliged to tell you where those contributions came from and identify their names and addresses?
Absolutely.
That go forward?
Yes, otherwise he's going to have to file as a political committee and tell us who they are.
So, and to follow.
But he shouldn't do that because they were all meant for the Fred Neal for Supreme Court campaign to begin with.
Right. But then you, as that illustrious candidate, are actually believing his documentation of where the contributions came from, and you enter the names that he provides you, and that's okay for you.
Yes, I'm not violating anything because certainly not the contribution of false name because I don't know otherwise.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
Yes. Again, this a simple little statute. It does have another component to it, and this deals with candidates who are only on the general election ballot, but if they spend more than $2,000 before the date of the primary, they have to file reports for the primary as though they were a candidate for the primary. And this has caught a few. We try to give candidates, especially minor party candidates and nonpartisan candidates.
Fred, where are you?
Still in Section 7.
Okay.
On the section-by-section analysis or summary, I'm on the last paragraph.
Okay.
And It was always meant to be aggregate, but the statute could be read that you had to get a contribution of more than $2,000, so you had to get an expenditure of more than $2,000 as opposed to aggregating over $2,000 prior to the primary. We've applied it as an aggregate, and we're asking you to follow up behind us and reinforce that. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. And Section 8 just corrects an erroneous internal statutory cross-reference. Section 9, I want to spend a little time just explaining these these first supplements and second supplements to the second pre-election report. These are the big, big money contributions that come in, or the big expense, more than $500 from a single source in the particular accounting period, or more than $1,000 expenditure to a single payee in the aggregate in that same period of time, from the 19th day before the election to the 5th day before the election, as drafted by council in 2001 and signed off by us in the waning days of the session. It ended up creating two different accounting periods to determine when you went over that $500 or when you went over the $1,000 in expenditures. And it's created quite a bit of a mare's nest there. We're trying to unravel it as best as possible while still meeting the desire to have these large contributions reported to the public in a timely fashion and large expenditures. So we're trying to make the aggregate apply over that entire 15-day period. You'd still have a deadline for filing one. If you got more than $500 from somebody by the 15th day before, you'd have to file a first supplement to the second pre. But just because you only got $499 from that person up to that period of time, if you got another $499 from them prior to the 5th day before, you would have gone over $500 in the entire period and would have to report that. There are four statutes that deal with reporting for primary and general elections, two for the primary, two for the general. One for candidates for the primary, one for candidates for the general, one for all other committees for the primary or other elections other than the general, and then one for all those committees, non-candidate committees, for non-general elections. And so this, we have to do this four times. Every time we tweak these reporting periods, we have to do it four times. And so this is the first one. I'm explaining it now, and I'll just brush over it in the other three statutes. Any question about supplements to the second pre? Okay. Thank you. Because on Section 9, federal candidates now file electronically, and with an agreement with the Federal Elections Commission, we do not have to receive nor keep hard copy reports from federal candidates on the Oregon ballots. We're trying to have the statutes catch up with us on that and eliminate the state statutory requirements, since superseded by federal law and intergovernal agreement with the Secretary of State, to keep them, candidates, from having to file hard copies with us. That's also in Section 9. Section 10 extends the supplement to the post-election report that many of you are familiar with. All of you should be familiar with it, whether you had to file one or not, prior to the legislative session. This would require even midterm, four-year terms, so it does not apply to state representatives, but would apply to state senators and statewide officials who are midterm, that they received contributions after the end of the accounting period for the post-election report for the general election that they weren't on the ballot for, through December 31st, they'd have to file a supplement to the post. Interestingly enough, and I just point out that the Superintendent of Public Instruction is not under that statute deemed a statewide official to file those reports. And so I made that clear in the italicized. And then again, it applies the aggregate thresholds for the supplements to the second pre to candidates in the general. Section 11, now we're into 073, which is for non-candidate committees in the general election. And and we're clarifying that that applies to caucus committees and candidate-affiliated committees, such as Speaker PAC or Bowl PAC, or ones that are associated directly with a particular public official candidate. And then applying the new aggregate thresholds. Yes, sir.
What defines... You just caught me off guard. I was reading ahead on you. Can you reference what that specific language is that you were just talking about? As regarded to affiliate PACs?
Yeah, it's on page 14 of the bill. It's subsection 2 of the statute, 073.
It's line correct.
Starts on 10.
Yeah, it starts on line 10.
Fred, I've got a question. Obviously, speaker pack. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, what it's doing is taking. It's saying $500, which is the posting. There's somehow $2,000 was inadvertently put in a previous amendment to it. That when the legislature raised the certificate of limited expenditures from $500 to $2,000, they didn't. They amended this inadvertently, and it shouldn't have been. It's
how would that apply to you? Let's just say as an example, you said speaker pack and bull pack, which speaker pack is obviously directly related to the speaker as a fundraising arm, if you will, and bull pack the same. If I were to start something along the lines of Derek Pack, but it was not related to the election of Derek in any way, shape, or form, but I am affiliated with that PAC. Do I fall under that same?
Yeah. Yes, you would.
Because I'm a current?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And interesting enough, the Campaign Finance Disclosure Panel dealt with that issue at length, and that their resolution of that issue is in Senate Bill 160 that you'll be seeing.
May I follow up there?
At some point.
Yes, please.
Would that be true even if I were the chief petitioner for an initiative campaign?
No.
Because that specifically refers to that and has a place for it, even though it was me doing it during my campaign, during my term.
Please, thank you for your indulgence.
Yeah, I know. I have a letter of advice to Representative Patridge. It goes back about 4 years. I'd have to confer, look at that again to give you a definitive answer.
Please do.
All right, we'll be happy to. Good. So thank you, Mr. Chair. We're on section 12, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
Good. section 12 deals with statements of initial assets. And the statute now says you just have to tell us how you got the money that you had in your beginning cash balance. And that always creates problems for committees. Our best advice for a number of years now has been, just because we won't let you be a committee because that initiative hasn't qualified to the ballot yet, doesn't mean you shouldn't start keeping your records in a way that you can thus report them as a detailed statement of contributions and expenditures. Otherwise, people really get their balances, their books messed up. And it's just simplest for them, and then it's also probably from the public. Where did the other contributions come from? Where did that other money get spent prior to this time? And this would actually codify that approach so that you use the same forms and you get to your balance so that you know exactly where you are when you file your statement of organization and your first pre-election report period began.
Representative Delta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, Section 12 deals mostly with initiative committees?
Initiative committees, well, committees that oppose initiative efforts. A chief petitioner committee, we think, is the only committee that is in favor of an initiative because anyone else spending money on it is making an in-kind contribution to the chief petitioner committee. They're not separately mounting their own initiative effort. They may be providing educational effort or person power, but those are still in-kind contributions, much as with the referendum issue on measure, was it measure 32? But but you have groups that oppose the signature gathering. They're they're raising money and spending it to staff the raising of and gearing up for a potential campaign in opposition to the initiative should it get enough signatures and be certified to the ballot. They can't be a political committee and file a statement of organization until we or the local filing officer certifies the measure to the ballot. At which point, if they're smart, they're already up and running. and have, we hope, for their sake, a good cash balance. And our advice has been for a number of years, as soon as you start, you should assume that that measure is going to make it to the ballot and start keeping your books in a way that allows you to report your detailed transactions just as though you were a political committee. If the measure never gets certified to the ballot, go spend the money on something else that's salutary for your supporters or return it to the contributors, but you never have to file a report. This statute only deals with the statement of initial assets, how you account for a beginning cash balance. A candidate committee isn't going to have, better not have, a beginning cash balance, because you're supposed to file a statement of organization and start, your accounting period begins within 3 days of receiving your first contribution or making your first expenditure.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Bobby. Please continue, Fred.
Okay. Okay. We are in 13. This simply clarifies that a political committee under 083, which is the guts of which you have to, any political committee has to report on their detailed reports. This says that a political committee that's making in-kind contributions or expenditures on behalf of committees or measures report that just as though they were now have to do it for candidates. And so we say that, but the statute doesn't really say that. So that would be nice. And it would help make sure that we're keeping track of and the public can keep track of money being spent on major campaigns. Okay. Section 14. Deletes the requirement that occupational information received from an inquiry letter to a contributor be reported on the next CNE report. There's no room on the form to do that. You've already moved on to a new accounting period. It doesn't make sense. None of you have ever done it, and we don't ask you to, and we like to get rid of that requirement. We still believe you should ask. And that's going to give you that information for future contributions from those contributors. But so that's Section 14. Section 15 corrects an erroneous reference to reporting period. Meant to report refer to an accounting period. Section 16 deals with ORS 26118, which is not political committees, but chief petitioner committees. There were some questions about those earlier. These deal with state and local chief petitioner committees, including recall. It's a complicated statute, to say the least. The first thing we do is to clean up the form. They don't have to tell us how they intend to raise money. I mean, all those little boxes at the bottom of page one by phone, by TV ad, by whatever. We've always said, just write in by all legal means. This is secondly, state chief petitioner committees have to file up to 4 reports since 2001. As September in the previous year report, if they go over $2,000, a February report in the even-numbered year in which they hope to qualify to the ballot, if they go over $2,000, and then all committees have heretofore since 2001 had to file a detailed report, whether they were even active, at the same time that you as candidates would be filing your second pre-election report in May, and then there's the original requirement for a 15th day after the deadline for filing initiative petitions in July report by all committees. We in this amendment would propose that the committees that have not gone over that $2,000 threshold by the end of the accounting period for the second pre-election for May not have to file reports in May. So if you have a dead effort, that we don't have to go find them, they don't have to find a treasurer to file something that's all zeros, and we'll all learn that in the middle of July. And that's the paragraph 2. Paragraph 3 is that provision I talked about earlier about making a specific reference back to, for recall petitioners, back to 249-865, so they know where to go to look to see what their responsibilities are. And our staff know where to guide them. Requires that you petitioner... The last paragraph is does get to the false swearing issue. Everybody has to attest to the truthfulness of their campaign finance reports, except for chief petitioners right now. And we think that that's not appropriate and that they should also have to attest to the truthfulness.
Fred?
Yes.
Do the same ramifications hold true for someone that signed by that change? Would they all be held to the same liability for submitting false statements?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. That is false swearing is a Class C felony.
Okay.
Good question.
Thank you.
Section 18, the clerks dearly love.
No.
They've. Oh, sorry, Section 17. Thank you, Representative. I am losing my place. It's such a simple bill. Allows the Secretary of State to impose civil penalty for failure to file a timely or sufficient statement of initial assets. That report never got. That statute that requires that report is missing from that series on civil penalties. So that's all that's doing. Section 18 makes permissive rather than mandatory the publication of a detailed, of a summary book of contributions and expenditures by county candidates at the county level. It's rarely complied with, and there's no discernible demand for such publications. If we can get to universal electronic filing by all state and local committees, summary books become a moot point. Anyway, we'll be asking you to repeal the requirement for the Secretary of State to publish a summary book for state campaigns. Section 19, 26402, clarifies that the crime of contribution in a false name applies to all political and chief petitioner committees. Making and receiving of a contribution in a false name is a Class C penalty. If you look at 402 and read it narrowly, which you really need to because it is a criminal statute, it says now, and that's in the italicized on page 21, lines beginning of line 14, no person shall make a contribution to any other person relating to a nomination or election of any candidate or the support or opposition to any measure in any name other than that of the person who in truth. And so you have chief petitioner committees out there with initiatives. Those aren't measures yet. You have political parties. They're none of the above. You have miscellaneous PACs that are none of the above. And the statute goes back 100 years. The level of players, the number of players and the entities they can create in order to be active politically has changed in the last 100 years, and this would apply then to all of those players.
Representative Greenman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Item 3, line 30 through 31 says if a person receives a contribution from a political committee, the person may enter the contribution into accounts of records it's received. Well, I don't understand the may. Shouldn't that be shall?
This is Representative Chair Kitz, Representative Greenlink. This is our legal counsel's best effort at somehow taking the last sentence that's currently in the statute. However, if the contribution is received from the treasurer of any political committee, it shall be sufficient to enter it as received from the treasurer. In a certain criminal complaint we had about over the statute, it was determined that it couldn't be enforced if the benefiting candidate was also the treasurer of one or more political committees, as well as his own political, his principal campaign committee, because of the current language, even though it may well have been an effort to hide the money or hide the source of the money, a knowing effort. They couldn't get to that conclusion to even go to a grand jury because of the language that seems to be exculpatory. It shall be sufficient.
Well, but you're doing
and
that
so
now.
May, I don't think is exculpatory. That's our. I spoke with the Criminal Justice Division yesterday about this matter as well. The campaign finance disclosure panel in Senate Bill 160 has a different take on this.
We're not saying May. How else could they enter it into the record is the question. Is there some other way that they could enter it into the record?
Well, if it were from, say, Billy Beer, I guess, who is has the check from a Georgia brewer.
This says political committee.
Right. And Billy Beer is not a political committee, then...
I'm not talking about
I know.
Political committee. The language here says that if I get a check from a political committee, I may enter it from that political committee. And I was asking you, what else could I enter it from except a political committee? And if there's nothing else, then it should be shall enter, I think.
I would hesitate to agree with you only that if the political committee received the contribution and it was earmarked for the Fred Neil for Supreme Court campaign.
A pass-through. That's not from the political committee, then.
Well, it is if it's been deposited by that committee.
Okay.
Even though it was earmarked. They should not have deposited it. They should have passed it on.
So they write a check, which you just told me you can't do because that makes you a political committee. I write a check and pass it on from PAC 325 and say, this isn't really from us, it's from somebody else.
And then you
but it isn't, it's from a political committee.
And
right?
Even with this language in here, if you knew that it was from that original source and not from the committee who's writing the check, then you're knowingly accepting a contribution in a false name.
Oh, and this says if I get that, and even though they said it was for Steve March, I could then enter it in the name of the political committee. This allows me to enter in the name of the political committee.
Provided you don't know that it was earmarked. Right.
No,
well, because the rest of the statute makes you liable if you knowingly receive.
Can I continue this?
Sure.
And I don't understand what this is for. I mean, it's either got to be shall, and then it says if I get it from a PAC, I must enter it as a PAC. Or if not, if I get it from a PAC and it says it's from Steve, then I need to enter it as from Steve, even though I got it from the PAC.
Right.
I hide that it comes from the PAC.
Let me take a step back for you, if I can. I've been struggling with this for a number of years and have gone back to the original Corrupt Practices Act 100 years ago and realized that was during the Progressive Era. It was campaign finance reporting. It was one of the first states to do so. And it also created political committees. It allowed for political action committees. They weren't quite called that, but weren't called PACs, but they were called political committees. And you could gather money from other people and then spend it on candidates and measures. And I think that this language that's in the current statute, this problematical language that seems to be more exculpatory than was ever intended by the Uren crowd in the turn of the last century, was put in there simply to allow to recognize the political committees, this new creature could occur, that you didn't have to, because you got a $10,000 check from the Georgia Beer Brewers, that somehow you had to also report every contribution the Georgia Beer Brewers political committee got, whether it was earmarked or not, in order to report it. And that's why we've left the May in, tried to save that concept by allowing for this permissive language. That just because the political committee got contributions from a number of people, you don't have to reach, penetrate that veil unless they were earmarked contributions. And that's where the rest of the statute, we believe, suffices for the knowingly receiving a contribution in other than the name of the real giver. And so it's just to recognize that political committees exist and to not get a high center on that. It may be that we all have learned to live with political committees. We recognize them enough and that this language isn't even necessary you know, 100 years later. But it's better than the language that's in the current statute, that's for sure.
President Greenland, is that adequately or at least temporarily?
In comment, I think not. I think if we've created political committees that have to report, they report where their money comes from. I don't care if it was your money. I have a political committee, the only function is to gather money for your campaign. As long as I'm behaving as a political committee and I'm recording and reporting the contributions to me, if I report, if I contribute to you as a political committee, it seems to me that should be shout. That you, seems to me, must report it as coming from me as the political committee. Even though everything, every single thing I collected was earmarked for you. So I don't understand the make, because I don't understand what else I could do. I get a check from the political committee, and then I go back. I have to get the political committee's reports and put something else in. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Chair Kitz, I'm not sure that's a question. Are you, but I, if you could clarify for me, are you saying that you should be able to raise as much money for me as possible and from other sources?
As a political committee.
As a political committee.
As long as I'm reporting.
And it's you're only spending it on me.
I'm only spending it on you. And I send you a check.
Well, I just don't understand why you wouldn't be an agent of my committee.
Well, okay, let's say...
Why have this? Why would you advocate this extra layer of...
I do it for Martian Kitz. I have a political committee that does nothing but gather money for Martian Kitz.
He's on the record as saying that now.
And I send Marsh half the check and Kitz half the check. Seems to me what Marsh has to do, since I'm reporting it, and I'm reporting it right, they have to say it comes from Mitch's political committee. How else can they report it?
Because it was intended for someone else.
What does it mean?
Because you've set up another layer of reporting. You might have even put it in a different jurisdiction, which some issues we're dealing with currently. Not a state PAC, or it's a state PAC, but you're supporting a local candidate and you're raising money, and so you file a report with the state. But the opponent of the local candidate doesn't know to go to Salem to look for this.
But I'm a new candidate, and I'm reading your things, and it says if I get a check from a PAC, I could report it as coming from that PAC.
If you know that it...
Well, who the hell else can I report it from? I mean, how else could...
You would report it from the person that meant to give it to you if it had been earmarked when it was given to that PAC. You would be obliged to.
And report it within and contribute it within 7 days.
As soon as you knew about it, as soon as you had the contribution, yes.
Representative, I think there's a loggerhead there. Maybe a disagreement that's not going to be resolved here at this time.
All I'm suggesting is that the Secretary of State's trying to clarify election law with this, and I would just like to comment to them that I'm not sure this may represent a clarification. Mm-hmm. I think it instead represents a point of confusion. There are a lot of things in here, so it's okay, but keep that in mind, I'd say.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that is, it's an ambiguous statute already. Section 20 is simply dealing with slave mailer organizations. There are very few, if any. We did get one last election cycle. It was a state slave mailer. They got to file with us, and then we realized that if it was a local slave mailer, they'd also have to file with us. And so this simply says we would, if you're a local slave mailer organization, you would file with that local jurisdiction, so the voters in that county or city would know that you were there. Again, 21 is just picking up 063, which is the aggregate thresholds for the second, for the supplements of the second pre. Section 22 deals with that recall C&E statute in 249 to make it clear that if information changed in your statement of organization, you'd have to file within 10 days like you would under 260. Section 23 deals with statements of contributions received during a legislative session. It says shall be filed. All the amendment does is say filed with the Secretary of State. Aww. And Section 25 corrects statutory references to annual September supplemental reports. Section 26 repeals the statute prohibiting the receiving of contributions during a legislative session. That was deemed unconstitutional by the Attorney General's Office in an opinion in 2001. It's been superseded by 076, amended in Section 23, and we simply ask that you repeal that statute. Section 27 is transition language for enforcement reporting purposes. That concludes this simple little housekeeping measures summary, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate your simple explanations to a simple bill. There are dash twos on this.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
I think they're self-explanatory.
They are. The first page 17 does is fix some dates for the deadline for filing a certificate of limited expenditure. The section 27 lines 4 through 6 simply incorporate what was a new statute and correct a series reference so that it's brought into relevance with the rest of the statutes.
Fred, thank you so much for your indulgence and your patience.
Thank you for your patience.
The questions. Appreciate you being here. At this time, I will call Kathy up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I just have a couple of comments to make about House Bill 2167. One of the principals of the League, which turned 85 years old yesterday on Valentine's Day.
Happy birthday.
Is that we support elections that are conducted in a manner which encourages voter participation and voting procedures which provide ease of ballot access as well as timely information about candidates and campaigns. And we believe that 2167 provides clarity to Oregon's election laws and transparency in campaign financing. One of the things that we feel is a better definition of fuller definition of independent expenditures is in 2167, and it includes both candidates and measures, and that significantly improve. And we believe that it significantly improves that process. It's also clear in 2167 about who shall file contribution and expenditures, when and when. It also clarifies what constitutes contributors and how they are to report, as well as stipulating reporting times. It codifies decisions and puts into statute language, which existed before only as directed, as directives. We believe that Oregon's election laws should empower both those running for office and the citizen who participates in the process. Again, HB 2167 continues the practice of regular reviews and updating to improve elections. We hope that the committee will vote favorably upon this measure.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. This time we'll call forward Sarah Weatherson. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Weatherson, and I'm with the Money in Politics Research Action Project. And the first thing I want to say is good bill should pass. And I also, way back when, started with Mr. Neal's testimony. You may remember his excellent going over what the independent expenditure piece does to clarify what we have heard from the court in Crumpton versus Kiesling. And I'm just going to the testimony that I've given you quotes the relevant piece in Crumpton versus Kiesling about independent expenditures. Basically, we're looking for a message in context that's clearly and unambiguously urging the election or defeat of a candidate. The message seeks an action rather than just giving information, and it's clear what the message advocates. Those are the three criteria in Crumpton versus Kiesling. In our opinion, in IFRAP's opinion, 2167 while clarifying independent expenditures from where it is now, doesn't quite meet the Crumpton versus Kiesling language. We anticipate that you will in the future see other bills in this body that will get closer to that definition, and I urge you to look for those and move those forward as well. But again, good bill should pass. All I have to say about HB 2167, and I'm happy if there are questions to take them.
Thank you, Shara. Seeing no questions, thanks
thank
again
you.
For taking the time to be here. So no further testimony on House Bill 2167. I've had some requests of the committee to wait on this bill and examine it further as a result of some of the things that have come up. I would ask that Jesse, can you wave to the committee? Jesse is with the Secretary of State's office. He will be able to answer any questions that some of the committee members have acknowledged they have on a more specific basis and possible amendments that will come forward as a result of some of the other discussions. I think some people brought up some good points that we could probably address here on this bill. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2167. We will hear the committee will stand at ease. In the sake of time, committee, because the committee will end at 3 o'clock, we will skip to committee will stand at ease for 1 second. A little longer than 1 second. Colleagues, we are going to postpone 2168. We are going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 162, and then we're going to attempt to move 2169 if time allows. So that being said, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 162. As a result, it has people from outside of Salem that wish to testify on it. Ruth Bendel is not here. I believe Sharon, you want to come forward?
This will be filled by
Chairman Kitt's committee, my name is Sharon Cornish. I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm filling in and reading the letter of Mike Delanisi and Ruth Bendel. Ruth has other appointments, and so I'm substituting. I've been in political arena of the Secretary of State's office for probably 30 years. As an observer and a poll watcher, I haven't been satisfied with vote by mail, mainly because it's not an absolute vote by mail. When I voted for that, I thought I'd be putting a stamp on an envelope and it would go direct, but it didn't turn out that way. Drop boxes were set up. And in poll watching, I've witnessed a lot of things that I've questioned. Drop boxes can be anything from a mailbox structure, simply for ballot drop-off, to a recycle bin. And mostly, they're recycle bins with no secure top. And when people pick them up, you don't know who they are. They're not identified with any specific ID on them. I've seen ballots picked up after 8 o'clock, and I've questioned it and called it in to the local election department. I went before my county commissioners on the last election because of Dropbox and requested money for a mailbox drop box to be put on the curb, and I got it within a couple days. If we're going to keep having drop box mail, we need that kind of security in all counties. That's another thing. There's no continuity between the counties within the state of the procedure. Another thing, we testified during the whole last election. Every day we went and volunteered. And every day we watched the process. On election night, I was there 21 hours. As an observer, you don't really get to observe. We're as far away, we're farther away than from where I am to your desk, trying to observe what's going on. And yet when the city of Hillsborough asked for a recount on their library bond, we were at the table observing with four other people recounting. Why is there a difference? We're also concerned about the early opening of the secrecy envelopes.
Sharon? Can I ask a question? I respect your concerns. I'm just trying to find out where they're related to Senate Bill 162.
Well, I don't know. This is Ruth's testimony.
Oh.
So I'm relaying the letter that you received to what she considers concerns in 162.
Okay. Please continue.
The secrecy ballots are opened early, 7 days, and they're simply put in shrink wrap. We would like the secrecy ballots to be opened the day of election. Once the ballot is taken out of the envelope, there's no way to identify it with the envelope.
I think your sidekick's here.
You want to take over? Go ahead.
Come on up, Ruth. Go ahead. Feel free. I think Sharon is reading your testimony.
It's almost done. This sounds just like the testimony we had last week. Mm-hmm.
It's a weekly
process. Yeah.
Okay.
What it relates to is the fact that we simply do not want...
Can you set your name for the record, please?
Oh, my name's Ruth Bendel, 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland, 97225. As long as vote by mail has got so many porous avenues to it, we do not want to see a bill passed that would remove any other options, namely returning to polling places from the face of the earth. Let's keep the institution with its options intact. Clean up vote by mail's implementation, and then, and only then, would I consider anything that's amended. And I'd like to point one other thing out. I was told recently there's nothing in Oregon state law that requires that that people be citizens in order to vote. And interestingly enough, in Senate Bill 162, down in the first section, under the definitions, an elector is referred to as how it's defined in Article 2, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution, which very clearly says a citizen must be 18 years of age and must be a resident for the past 6 months. So you already have it codified in Oregon law that there is a requirement of citizenship in your definition of an elector. So while we are struggling with a new bill, House Bill 2583, to require proof of citizenship, in actual fact, these series of bills that you're trying to amend to remove the existence of anything but vote by mail actually does spell out the fact of what an elector is. It is what is required in Article 2, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution. I just thought that was important, and I want to make sure that that isn't going to be in any way amended in the process of Senate Bill 162. Thank you for listening.
You bet. Thank you, Ruth, for taking the time to come down here, and thank you to Mike Balanese, who I'm sure is listening at home via the computer, for his emails along with you. I get them and read them.
Yeah.
So thank you,
thank
both
you.
Of you. Appreciate it. And Sharon, thank you for reading Ruth's testimony in her absence.
I was hoping to escape having to do anything for the
thing. I understand. I've had those days myself. Andy Miller, if you would come forward, please.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the executive director of Common Cause Oregon. Common Cause is a public interest group. Our primary focus these days has been on election reform at the national level. We feel fortunate in Oregon we have such a good system, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of that system. 162 simply amends the existing statute to reflect reality, repeals language like polling place, punch card, poll book. Vote by mail elections are hugely popular with the voters and contribute, pardon my typo there, to our high voter turnout. Common Cause has been a longtime supporter of vote by mail. In response to positive comments and questions about our system, we are encouraging our chapters in other states to look at Oregon's excellent system of voting. We urge you to pass Senate Bill 162 and require all elections in the state to be conducted by mail.
Andy, thank you for your testimony today. Thank you for coming down. At this time, we'll call John Lindbeck.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just while we're waiting, may I make a comment?
Representative Dalta, while we're waiting that 5 seconds for Mr. Lindbeck to come up, I would love to hear a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just was confused a little bit by Ms. Bendel's testimony about the question about citizenship and being able to become a registered voter. And I think her statement was something to the effect of you don't have to be a citizen to register to vote. I'm not sure. We don't have a stenographer to read it back, but I think that's what she said. So I was curious about that, having read the voter registration form many times. And I think, you know, this. I'm not so sure that she's completely accurate in her statement. I have two versions, I guess, of the voter registration card. And in both cases, it says, are you a citizen of the United States of America? Check yes or check no. And it says, will you be at least 18 on or before election day? Check yes, check no. It says, if you check no in response to either of those questions, you do not complete this form. So I don't know how more explicit you can get, but Mr. Lindbeck, you have any ideas?
Right. Actually, Representative Dahl, I think that, I agree with that. I think what Ms. Bendel's concern, one of the many, is that it's not required proof. It's simply checking the box. So, for example, if I am someone who should possibly check no there, and I check yes, there's no way to verify, I is my understanding. So I think she wants required documentation, something other than a driver's license, which I think Ms. Bendel, and I hate to speak on her behalf, deems that that is not an accurate or an effective way to verify someone's yes or no answer on that form.
But Mr. Chair, I think, isn't it a crime to falsely sign up to register to vote?
I believe, yes, it is a crime, and I believe that, yes, that regardless of whether or not it's a crime to do many things. People do them anyway. We don't need to go into specifics. But so I think that that's what she's going at, is that people will knowingly check yes and start voting in the process when they probably shouldn't, and it's only if they're caught that they're... I believe that's your concern.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the wonderful question, Representative Delta.
Sure.
I've got Ruth's phone number here if you'd like to call her for any further clarification.
That would be necessary.
Mr. Lindbeck, thank you for being here today. Please continue. Or please start, I guess.
For the record, I'm John Lindbeck. I'm a Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Senate Bill 162 really makes no changes to how elections are currently conducted in Oregon. All elections are now conducted by mail. So the purpose of this bill is to delete sections of election law that are no longer in use and that now create confusion from time to time. As you know, in 1988, the citizens of Oregon voted by a wide margin, just shy of 70% approval, to conduct all primary and general elections by mail. This was done by citizen initiative. Surveys conducted by the University of Oregon have shown a consistent increase in citizen approval of this election system. Late last year, Priscilla Southwell of the University of Oregon released her latest survey showing voting by mail has an 80% favorability rating. For many years, county clerks have had the option in statute to conduct non-state elections either via mail or by statute. Over the course of the past 20 years, all elections conducted by counties have been converted from polling place elections to by mail elections. Clerks will tell you why. Increased turnout, lower cost, voters approve of the convenience, etc. Annette Newingham, chair of the Clerks Association Legislative Committee, is here today, and I'm sure she would be glad to answer any questions related to that subject. Vote by mail is here to stay, and the current polling place statutes are no longer needed, and this bill provides the legislature the rare opportunity to get rid of some laws rather than pass new ones. And I can take you through the bill section by section if you would prefer.
Wine.
Committee, we won't be moving this bill today, so I don't know that it's necessary at this time. It's not to say that we're not interested. It's just saying maybe not at this time.
Chairman Kipps, we just...
We're no longer providing coffee for the committee, so I think the preparation that would be required for such a bill...
We just passed out a section-by-section summary, and we grouped all of the sections into categories. And it's really not as complicated as it looks. If you read through the section-by-section summary, we have those categories for you, and they tell you which section falls into which category, and it's fairly simple, really.
Great.
Really honest.
Sure. Technical fixes.
Yeah.
Isn't that right, Mr. Neal? Technical fixes. Committee, any questions at this time on this bill, or do you want to save them for the later time when we decide to move forward?
You don't want to move a bill?
Yeah, I thought we were going to break the record here.
Come on. Thank you very much for testifying. I guess the last person then would be Kathy.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's so nice early in the session to be on a first name basis.
I appreciate that. I'm Derek.
I'm Kathy Eaton, for the record, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As our name implies, we are very much interested in encouraging people to participate in government. That's our purpose. And we want people to be involved. We have been a proponent of vote by mail for more than two decades. When it first started doing school boards of vote by mail, it was valid then. It was an easy way for people to participate. And the primary election and general election editions have further proved its value. Andy Miller has always referred to the things that this bill simply deletes. It is a bill that cleans it up, takes things that are no longer needed out of statute. It's working very well in Oregon. It gives easy access to voting, and it improves citizen participation. As Mr. Lindbach told you last week, our Secretary of State Bradbury told you, we had an 86.5 voter participation in the general election, and that certainly is part of the vote-by-mail process that we have. So we urge you to move 162 and get on with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 162. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2169. John, come on forward. You want to read this one? Cletus, if you would just give us the outline of 2169 before John testifies, it would be great.
HB 2169 modifies division of definition of voting machine, allows Secretary of State to revoke approval of voting machine or vote tally systems if machine or system does not comply with law. Prohibits the Secretary from approving voting machine unless machine contains devices that duplicate votes cast by electorate onto paper record copy and allow electorate to view paper record copy, and directs the county clerks to enter ballots cast using voting machines into valid vote tally systems, and specifies the ballot cast using voting machines that paper record copy is counted as ballot to be used in a recount.
Mr. Lindbach, thank you.
And for the record, I'm John Lindbach, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. The Help America Vote Act is the impetus behind some sections of this bill. I think some of you have heard that that starting in January 1, 2006, this federal law requires each state to have a system in place for voters with disabilities to be able to vote privately and independently, just like fully able-bodied people. Obviously, we're looking to technology to provide the answers to this issue, and why we need certain sections of this bill. For example, the section that amends the definition of voting machines to include the use of DRE, which stands for Direct Recording Electronic Voting System. That's Section 1. I like to refer to those, rather than DREs, as touchscreen voting machines, because I think people just understand that phrase better. The touchscreens that have been pretty controversial in other states for use by all voters, we need to amend our definition of voting machine to incorporate those here, because those may well have the answer for us in providing the needed technology to voters with disabilities for their ability to vote privately and independently. We don't know that we're going to use them. We have a disability subcommittee working with us on the Help America Vote Act that's going to make recommendations And we're going to have a vendor fair in the state capitol on April 4th, in which you will all be invited to go and test this technology yourself and see what you think, and so will members of the disabilities community. And so everybody, including you, can go and sort of kick the tires and see what these different proposed technologies are all about. But for purposes of planning here, in order for us to make sure that our statutes are in line with HAVA, we need to amend this definition of voting machine to incorporate the use of DRE. Now, it has another section in it that your committee administrator referred to, and that requires a voter-verified paper audit trail in case we decide to use any of those touchscreen machines, and that's been the controversial subject in other states. We want to avoid a situation like we had in California where a bunch of these DRE systems were approved. The Secretary of State, after these things had been deployed and purchased by a number of counties, said, okay, you got to have a paper audit trail, and they had to go back and spend a bunch more money in retrofit machines that had already been deployed in their counties. It was a mess, and they're still trying to straighten it out, and we don't want to, we want to learn by their example and not recreate that mess in Oregon. Plus, our state elections plan, which was prepared under the terms of the Help America Vote Act, says that any touchscreen voting machines used in Oregon should have the voter-verified paper audit trail in it, and so we want to step forward and carry forward our elections plan and be in compliance with that. Plus, the other reason for it is that we have a state law that says all recounts in Oregon must be done by hand. And if you're going to hand recount stuff out of a touchscreen voting machine, you can't hand recount the electrons. You pretty much need that piece of paper. So there's lots of good reasons about why we need that and need these provisions in this bill. Another section of the bill, Section 2, would amend the statute to allow the Secretary of State, in consultation with county clerks, the authority to decertify voting systems based on noncompliance with Oregon state law on voting machine equipment. Currently, we discovered the Secretary of State has the authority to certify machines, but the explicit authority is lacking in state law to actually decertify a machine if the Secretary should determine that those machines are somehow out of compliance with our statutes on 246550, in which it outlines the requirements on voting machines and how they should be used. We think that was an oversight, but technically, if the secretary, some secretary in the future, needed for good reasons to decertify a machine, there could be an issue raised about whether or not he technically has the authority to do that. And so that pretty much covers the highlights of this bill. I'm certainly, if you have any further questions, outlines the. I just wanted to cover the highlights of why we feel it's needed and why we'd like you to consider it today.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Limbeck, I think this is actually more in line with current practice rather than this particular bill, because this particular bill is anticipating people who can see. But currently we have a Braille ballots for those who are blind. Is that correct?
Actually, no, we don't. We have one county that has a tactile ballot. That a blind voters in Marion County have used for a number of years and have been happy with it. But in the other counties, we do not have Braille ballots in Oregon. They're not all blind people can read Braille, for one thing, and so it's not necessarily the answer for the entire community that has trouble with their sight. What we have in law now is the ability, if you're a voter with a disability, be you blind or some other kind of disability, and you need assistance in marking your ballot, you can call your county elections office and they will send out a couple of people that can help you, people of opposite political parties who have been trained on how to assist that voter with voting. But it lacks that privacy and independence that's called for. We need to resolve that problem under the new federal law.
So in the new federal law, you're anticipating both oral and visual?
Yes, we're looking for technology that will solve this problem. Now, these DREs that address the problems of a lot of different kinds of disabilities, you know, they have, if you can't see but you can hear, they have headphones, and you'll be able to see this on April 4th. I hope you all go take a look. But they have headphones, and they lead the person using it on how to use the machine and record their votes. The answer to a lot of these disabilities is in technology like DREs or something else. We're also looking at the possibility of telephone voting. There will be all kinds of things to look at the vendor fair on the 4th of April.
Thank you.
So, Limbeck, have you the county clerks, they're okay with this legislation? I mean, the ramifications out of there?
As far as I understand, yes.
Nodding back there.
Thanks for the nod. I'm glad that we're on a nodding basis. Any other questions? Oh, sorry. Okay. Representative Thatcher.
I don't think it's too hard of a question. I'm just trying to picture. Right now, with vote by mail, we aren't required to have paper copies of you know, the ballot cast. Who's in possession of the paper copies?
Under vote by mail?
Yeah. Well, no. Of this right here, of the DRE.
The versions of the DREs, the paper copy, is verifiable by the voter, but remains in the possession of the county.
For the purpose of hand count.
Right. Situations. Correct. Yeah, and that's a. I'm glad you asked that question, because that's been a controversial question raised in other states about the voters are not to take the receipts with them. There's been various allegations that people could use that for vote selling or some other thing, and therefore, Las Vegas, Clark County, and Nevada did a. Well, actually, all of Nevada used DREs with this voter verifiable paper audit trail. In their primary election last year, and a lot of people from the nation went around and watched, and they actually have these scrolls that are attached to the side of the DRE, they're under glass so that they can't be touched, but the voter can look at them as they scroll up and verify their vote.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kathy Eaton of the League of Oregon or League of Women Voters, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to take very much of your time. The League supports this bill. The three things that we want to leave with you. The language ensures that ballots in Oregon will be counted accurately, that there are changes that can be made by the state elections official if there is a malfunction, and that every vote cast has a paper trail. And as Mr. Limbach told you, the voting machine is going to be used primarily by disabled voters under the supervision of the county. The League in three counties this past primary or general election had an opportunity to assist county officials in going to nursing homes to help disabled people if they wish to vote. And that's the process that we've been using. So we're looking forward to having a process which has the DREs and they can vote electronically. But this is an important bill. I've been privileged to serve on the HAVA steering committee, and one of the mandates is that there has to be better access for disabled people to voting. So this is an important bill, and we hope we'll move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions or testimony, we'll close the public hearing on 2169 and open a work session on 2169.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mark.
I would move House Bill 2169 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March moves House Bill 2169 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Thatcher.
I just have one. Is every bit of this change having to do with the Help of America vote now.
Mr. Lindback, you want to address that?
I'm looking through the, excuse me, John Lindback from the Secretary of State's office. I'm going through the sections here so that I can make sure I answer this accurately. Definition of voting machine is definitely DRE and HAVA related. That's section one. Section two, that is not explicitly HAVA related. That's the issue I raised about the secretary being able to decertify voting systems if there's a problem with them and they no longer comply with statutes. Section three is HAVA related. That's the paper, voter verified paper audit trail. It's part of our HAVA state plan.
And removing the punched.
Right. Section 4 amends the statute to include the definition of voting machine. Section 5 amends the statute to allow county elections officials to include the ballots cast in DREs into the vote tally system, so that's HAVA related. Section 6 amends the statute to allow for ballots cast using a voting machine to be included in the ballots in the event of a recount, and so that is HAVA related as well. So everything except the issue about the decertifying of voting machines.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Seeing no further questions, the clerk will call the roll.
Chair,
yes. Chair votes aye.
Mr.
Gatto. Votes aye.
Mr.
Aye.
Mr.
Aye.
Mr.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. 169 passes. Any further discussion for the good of the committee?
Mr. Chair, you might wish to designate a carrier.
That's a good idea, Representative Dalto.
Or you might wish to place on the consent calendar.
Representative Dalto, would you like to carry this bill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for carrying this bill. Representative Dalto will be assigned 2169.
No good deed.
Representative, if you have concern about carrying the bill, I'm more than happy to assign someone else.
I would be pleased to carry it.
Thank you. Representative Dalto will carry 2169 in a diligent fashion. Any other discussion for the good of the whole?
Yeah, I want to save my carrying for Neil's bill.
Adjourned. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr.